Okay, the next case for us to hear today is Laureano v. Attorney General, appellate number 24-2433.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Rebecca Hufstadter. I'm from Legal Services of New Jersey, and I'm pro bono counsel for petitioner Patria Laureano, who's here in court today. May I please reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal?
You may.
Thank you. I will be addressing why the Attorney General's decision in matter of YL conflicts with the statute as well as the CAT claim, and my colleague Ms. Rael Muto will address the lack of reason basis for the YL decision.
Can you begin by addressing Riley? Because I don't take you to dispute Riley's interpretation of 1252B1 as being applicable here.
No, Your Honor. Riley, the holding of Riley was related to timeliness and held that while the final order was with the reinstatement order, that time bar is not jurisdictional, and it was waived in this case by the government.
Why was it waived in this case?
The government indicated that the petition was timely on page 4 of its brief.
Then the government acknowledged that there was a case pending in the Supreme Court, which was Riley.
They have to make that acknowledgement in the responsive brief, but they noted that Riley was pending, and then subsequent to that, they notified this court that Riley's been decided, and it says it's a 30-day window. And I didn't take you to dispute that Riley's holding, which I don't think you could, or that it would seem to apply here.
Correct, Your Honor. But I would dispute the characterization of the government's brief. The government could have indicated that it wants to preserve that issue for future review in light of the pending decision in Riley. Instead, it said this petition was timely. That's an explicit waiver.
But it was under our precedent at that point. I mean, under Interstoza, there's no question it was timely. Where do you get the authority from that the waiver argument needs something more than that in light of what they argued?
Your Honor, I think from Barna that it's an explicit decision not to press that issue, despite knowing that the Riley case was on appeal to the circuit. I would add that, you know, if the court disagrees, the deadline is, as it's non-jurisdictional, is subject to equitable tolling, and we'd respectfully ask for additional briefing on that issue. Although I didn't actually take the government's 28J letter now to disagree with the statement in our 28J letter that the issue had been waived. The government's 28J letter relates to another part of Riley, but didn't even now actually press the issue of timeliness. So,
okay. And we could talk about the other part related to the CAT claim when we get to that, but I understand your point. You argue it's waived, and we'll hear from your adversary on that question.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. So turning back to matter of YL, matter of YL constrains the agency, the IJs and the BIA, to treat convictions for drug trafficking offenses differently from all other kinds of crimes when deciding whether they're particularly serious crimes. And three rules of statutory construction show that categorical rule conflicts with AUSC 1231.
Why is it a categorical rule? I mean, it's subject to exceptions. It's a rebuttable presumption. It has been rebutted in cases that the United States has put forward that we have decided. So how is it a categorical rule?
Your Honor, it's a categorical rule because it applies to a category, drug trafficking offenses, and it applies in a mechanistic way. It's not a traditional rebuttable presumption like the Irwin presumption that's at issue in some of the cases my friend cited in his brief, where it puts a thumb on a scale, but the adjudicator can consider all the evidence, all the facts, and ultimately make a determination about whether the presumption has been rebutted.
Well, the adjudicator is the Attorney General, right? I mean, who's the adjudicator?
The IJ. I'm saying in this particular case.
The Attorney General can't set standards for the determination here. I mean, the IJ is an employee of the Justice Department who works for the Attorney General, right? Or, I mean, because this is something that came up in your brief, and I wasn't sure if that's what you're actually arguing. So is your point that under the statute, the only authority that can be exercised here is by an IJ, not the Attorney General?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. So
no.
The Attorney General can set guidelines and standards and principles.
Absolutely.
So why isn't that what the Attorney General did here?
Because the Congress intended for an individualized case-by-case adjudication. And so the Board of Immigration Appeals has set guidelines in other cases. And absolutely, if the Attorney General had said, I think that in drug cases, these factors are going to be particularly relevant when the IJ is weighing all the factors, he could have absolutely done that. But that's not what YL does.
I mean, that's not what the statute says. I assume this is your kind of historical argument that if you look at what was passed before, and that's what we should assume Congress meant. I mean, would you agree that's not what the second sentence in the statute says, that it's an individualized determination?
No, I think that's what it means. So it says that the Attorney General is not precluded from determining that an alien, that it indicates individualized determination case by case.
An alien?
Right.
But the first sentence used the phrase an alien as well. And you agree that's a categorical determination.
It's a categorical rule, although there's going to have to be a determination. It relates to type of offense and sentence. So the IJ is going to say, here's a person. Did that person have an aggravated felony conviction? Was the sentence 5 years? And then go on to, if
that's
no.
That's what they're doing under YL too, right? I mean, they're looking at, because I understand your textual point, but it struck me that the same language is used in the first sentence. And obviously you're not debating that the first sentence doesn't mean what it says. And so how does that erode? Doesn't that kind of undermine your argument about the best reading of the statute?
I don't think it does, Your Honor, because if the Congress had wanted to delegate authority to the agency to create rules about types of offenses, it knew exactly how to do that. It did that in the asylum statute, 1158B2B2. It says that the Attorney General can designate by regulation categories of offenses. So the court should draw a negative inference from the failure to include that exact provision, which is in the asylum, particularly serious crime statute, and not in the withholding of removal
statute. So is your problem with what YL is it was labeled a presumption as opposed to factors for consideration, and the implication of a presumption in some way makes a blanket statement about something that could be rebutted, but the blanket statement about that something meaning drug trafficking offenses is not individualized. Is that your argument?
I don't think how you label it matters. It's how it works. So under YL, a person, in order to rebut the so-called presumption, has to meet each and every of the six factors plus show other unusual circumstances. So that's nearly impossible to meet. The government has cited two cases in 23 years where the presumption was actually rebutted. Some of those six factors that people have to show in order to rebut it are internally inconsistent. For example, you have to show a peripheral role in the drug trafficking scheme, but you have to also show no impact on minors. But like my client, if you truly have played a peripheral role, how could you know where each of the drugs went and who possibly used those drugs? So it's really very difficult.
My point was that the criteria that she cannot meet is the quantity criteria, the controlled substance, because of Aquila.
Right, right. And so that's because of the statute of conviction. She was convicted under a statute that doesn't involve a small amount. So the IJ couldn't go any further. The BIA even said, the BIA said in footnote 3, these are sympathetic circumstances, but this wasn't the weight is so much that it outweighs all the other factors. That's not how YL works. The IJ and the BIA were constrained from considering all those other factors. And that's why it's not a traditional, if you want to call it a rebuttable presumption or multi-factor test. It's mechanistic and it just grains discretion rather than just guiding discretion. I see I'm out of time. Would the court like me to address the CAT claim briefly? Or should I save it for rebuttal?
Yeah, I mean, I'd be interested in your thoughts on Riley as well. Like, what did Riley do to our jurisdiction on that? Since, as I read, the CAT claims presentment, it has to come through the petition for withholding of removal. And if Riley applies to that, then there's a vehicle with which to bring the CAT claim, right?
Your Honor, I think that's based on a one justice concurrence.
I'm just reading the statute. I'm not. Let's quietly aside then for a moment. It seems as though that's what are we looking at here?
2242D says you can't, no court has jurisdiction to consider a CAT claim except as part of the review of a final order of removal. And so it seems like you're back into it. I understand that issue wasn't presented in Riley because the government hadn't claimed the applicability, but what's your thought on the best reading of the statute?
And so we would respectfully request supplemental briefing if the court wants to issue decision. But briefly, Your Honor, this is as part of a review of a final order of removal. We now know after Riley that the final order of removal was issued earlier than we thought it was. So it's not the one that we listed in the initial petition. And we could, of course, amend the language of the petition. But ultimately, that order that was issued originally can't be executed until the CAT claim is resolved. And so we are seeking review of that order in addition to the withholding and CAT claims. Okay.
We'll
thank
you.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks.
Good day. May it please the court. Trina Real Muto on behalf of Amicus National Immigration Litigation Alliance. Whether a matter of YL creates either a per se rule or so close to a per se rule is really a distinction without a difference. I'd like to address what I think is the roadmap to reversal, which is why the decision is inconsistent with two decisions that came out after YL. The first is the Supreme Court's decision in Judelang, and the second is former Attorney General Garland's decision in matter of BZR. But let me just start with 20-second backdrop to put this in context. Remember that YL is a one-man decision. When Ashcroft issued that decision, he rejected a 15-member unanimous BIA panel.
Well, he's the Attorney General counsel, right? I mean, it's not one man. It's the Attorney General of the United States.
I'm just also,
but since you're bringing up the timetable, it was counsel. Can I?
Yeah. Go ahead.
It was in 2002, right?
Correct.
So this is a very long time that this has been sitting here, and correct. Congress has not seen fit to reconsider that determination. So I want to sort of understand how you think that longstanding custom that's now arisen around YL might be
relevant. Well, I'd refer the court to Demarest versus Manspeaker. Just because an age interpretation is longstanding doesn't mean that it's legitimate. It is true that in this court's jurisprudence, no one has really challenged the validity of the YL test. And so this becomes a question of first impression for this court.
Has it been decided by any circuit?
No, the First Circuit came close to deciding it. It was very concerned about the fact that the government was unable in the 23 years that the case has been in effect to actually show that the presumption has been rebutted. But that's why I say whether it's a per se rule or so close to a per se rule, that's a difference without meaningless.
You know what happened in the First Circuit case back in the agency?
The case is still before the immigration, on appeal now, back before the BIA.
So what do you know what the IJ did?
I think that the person could not rebut the presumption.
So they embraced the YL presumption.
Right, and so he'll have to go back up to the Court of Appeals as the Court of Appeals invited him to do, because the IJ in that case didn't actually apply the test. So YL is an outlier. Every single other kind of offense, the agency applies a multi-factor test. And baked into that test is an assessment of dangerousness. The agency looks at your conviction, type of sentence, circumstance, and facts underlying conviction. They also look at coercion, duress, mental health. These factors are not allowed to be considered in the YL analysis. And Ashcroft expressly prescribed consideration of cooperation with law enforcement authorities, limited criminal histories, downward departures, sentencing. These factors are germane to a particular serious crime analysis because they bear on the severity of the offense and dangerousness. In Judelang, the Supreme Court rejected the BIA's approach to deeming certain non-citizens ineligible for relief, found it was arbitrary and capricious and unmoored from the purpose of the statute because the BIA precluded consideration of germane factors relevant to their fitness to stay in the country. Here, the purpose of the withholding statute is to protect people from facing persecution. No purpose is served by precluding consideration of factors relevant to whether or not their offense is so particularly serious that they're dangerous. And then in BZR, former Attorney General Garland reversed a BIA decision barring consideration of mental health evidence after two courts of appeals rejected the exclusion of that evidence in the particular serious crime analysis. Just as opposing counsel argues in this case with respect to evidence of coercion and duress, which may or may not be present in this case, but of course this court is looking at the agency's interpretation of the statute because that's going to apply to all people in all cases, and people do commit crimes under coercion and duress. In BZR, the board, Garland reversed the board's exclusion of that evidence. And he rejected that rationale and explained that particularly serious crime determinations and criminal culpability are two distinct questions. All relevant evidence may not have been presented to the criminal court. And evidence of a, he expressly says, evidence of the non-citizen's motivation and intent can be relevant to the dangerous analysis. It was wrong to categorically exclude mental health evidence. And that's been the BIA's position for all other types of offenses, that all relevant evidence must be considered. Garland's rationale applies similarly to allowing consideration of the factors that YL bars. And so I see my time's up. I can briefly touch on dangerousness, or I can sit down.
Let me see if my colleagues have any questions, just to sure. No, I think we're good. Thank you for your argument.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Anthony Nardi on behalf of the Attorney General.
I guess I'd like to know your position on the jurisdictional question and also why it took you so long to respond to the petitioner's 28-J letter.
Yes, Your Honor. I was going to turn to Riley first. So I think there's two questions on Riley, and I'll address both of them. First, there's the timeliness. We do not think we waived the timeliness of the petition in our brief because we did note that Riley was pending before the Supreme Court. However, I don't think that issue matters, is because we think with respect to the timeliness, the court can move to the merits of this case and doesn't need to decide that question. However, with respect to the jurisdiction, we raised that more recently, however, because sua sponte, two other courts of appeals have asked the court, or have asked the government about our view on Justice Thomas's concurrence and whether or not the court has jurisdiction over those CAT withholding claims.
I'm confused, counsel, because this seems like a critical point here when you say, no, we did raise it and Riley is applicable, but we don't think it matters and you can reach the merits. I mean,
Your Honor, specifically the timeliness, as my friend on the other side said, is a non-jurisdictional claims processing rule, and therefore we don't think the court needs to delve into the tolling analysis on the timeliness of raising the petition. However, there is the jurisdictional element of whether or not the CAT claim and the withholding claim are zipped up under 1252B9 and then A4.
Are you asserting Riley applies here, or are you not?
Your Honor, candidly, I am not asserting it does or does not. We agree that there would need to be further supplemental briefing on that particular question. This is a very recent issue, and there's active briefing going on. We have not turned general.
I think Judge Mady might have been asking you about the timeliness point, not the CAT point.
Not the CAT point.
Oh, sorry. Yes, with respect to the timeliness point, we don't think it is relevant to this case here.
You're not pressing it.
We're not pressing it in this case, correct, Your Honors.
Okay.
However, with respect to the jurisdictional argument, because the court has to assure itself of its own jurisdiction, we think that would require further additional briefing.
Oh, what's your position today?
Your Honor, again, candidly, I'm not taking a position because we have not formulated a position internally because it is a developing issue. And two courts of sua sponte requested briefing on this issue. We are still developing that briefing and determining the agency's position.
What was the point of the 28-J letter then, counsel? I'm perplexed now. The United States brings these issues to the court's attention, but now it's not prepared to actually illuminate on?
Your Honor, we're only bringing these to your attention because other courts asked us for our position on that. We think because the court has to assure itself of its own jurisdiction, we need to bring that to the court's attention, and we would not want to raise that later in another case. We want to raise
it. You can offer no position on the subject.
Correct, Your Honor.
So we are left to our own devices.
Your Honor, that's why, again, we think we...
But if we decline that...
It's not like Riley was decided yesterday.
Yeah.
Correct, Your Honor. However, the other...
It's not like Riley is particularly hard to decipher either. I mean, Riley couldn't be clearer in its holding of the jurisdictional component regarding the timeliness of the claims processing role, and naturally tees up a question regarding the CAT jurisdiction. And so I like Judge Fisher,
Your Honor, again,
I'm confused.
again, Your Honor, the department was not affirmatively raising these claims. It was other courts sua sponte asking us for our views on it, and we are still internally developing our views on that question. But again, because the court has to assure itself its own jurisdiction, if the court would like our views on that, we of course would.
I do have a position on whether Riley, on the jurisdictional point, only deals with the CAT claim. Is it your position it only applies to CAT, not statutory withholding?
Your Honor, I do not have a position on that right now, no. I'm not authorized to give a position on that.
But your colleagues on the other side.
Wait a minute, let me stop here. Yeah. You said two things. You don't have a position, then you said you're not authorized.
Your Honor, I was amending the first.
Are you not giving us a position because you're not authorized to? Because Judge Schwartz asked you for your position.
Your Honor, I'm not authorized to take a position on this issue right now because there's still internal deliberations.
That's ridiculous. I mean, I know you're the Department of Justice, and I understand it's a big agency, but you're counsel in front of this court. And for you to say you can't give us an answer because you're not authorized.
Especially when it comes to the power of the court to even adjudicate a matter that's been presented to it by a petition that was filed long ago, that's been implicated by a case that was decided 3 months ago. It's I have to echo my colleagues. It's difficult for us to understand when it goes to the power of the court to decide matters that are before the department all the time. And I say that based on the number of immigration cases, we have these issues raised all the time. So assume we're not going to give you leave to file supplemental briefs.
Your Honor, again, I'm not authorized to take position.
Well, I mean, I'll go back to your colleagues on the other side mentioned the possibility of supplemental briefing. I know there's other issues before the court, but perhaps that's the way we'll choose to deal with it. But
we'll let you know.
Let me ask you another sub-question. You said you've been asked by other circuits.
Yes.
Have you given the other circuits who have asked a question an answer?
To my knowledge, Your Honor, we have not as of yet. There's the Fourth and the Ninth Circuit.
I was asking for, if you answered the question to them, maybe you'd give us
can't even take a position on whether only applies to CAT.
Your Honor, I don't want to take a strong position. That's to my personal knowledge. I'm not sure, but I could be wrong on that. There might have been briefs filed. I'm not handling those cases.
Right. Are you able to take a position on whether this jurisdictional question that was raised really in one concurrence applies only to CAT?
I cannot, Your Honor.
I think you understand our position.
I do.
You understand our question, and we understand the difficulties of a big operation like Department of Justice. But, you know, we are a court, and I know you're in front of courts with great frequency. And, you know, maybe you can take back the message that, you know, when you're sent up here to Philadelphia on a case, you'd be better served, or the department would be better served if you could articulate a position.
Of course, Your Honor. I understand that completely. Yes.
Let's move on to the presumption. Presumptions are based on a collection of things that have happened in the past to make an inference about something in the future. How is that an individualized determination?
Your Honor, I think fundamentally the question here is two pieces. What does the statute allow the Attorney General, what types of rules does the statute allow the Attorney General to make?
Well, he made a rule.
Yes, Your Honor.
How does that rule comport with the interpretation that this court has given in the second sentence of the operative statute?
Because I think both sides here agree that this court in Chong looked at
the start of Valle, en banc.
Yes, Your Honor.
We looked at that statute.
Yes.
Concluded it was a case-by-case analysis for the second sentence.
Yes.
So we've interpreted that clause to mean that thing. How is the presumption, as articulated by the Attorney General in YL, not an individualized consideration?
Well, Your Honor, we believe it is an individualized case-by-case determination. We think there's at least two panels of this court that have also looked at matter of while and come to the same conclusion that it does allow for the type of case-by-case determination that is required both by the statute as recognized by Chong as a matter of due process. I would point the court both to Ford and to Marsan. Both of those cases, the court was looking at matter of YL, and in both cases held that yes, the matter of YL presumption allows for that individualized determination.
Was the presumption challenged in those two cases?
Your Honor, I believe it was in Ford. I do not believe it was in Marsan. However, I think that.
And were they in precedential decisions?
No, neither of them were precedential decisions, Your Honor.
Did the start of volume require it or did it permit it? Because I'm not sure of that point. I thought we held that it
we were considering whether it permitted an individualized decision, and we said indeed it did. And I'm not sure I read it to say that it required it. And then obviously there's your further point of why isn't this an individualized determination? And I don't understand the petitioners to be saying there was never an individual consideration of my petition. What they're saying is it shouldn't have been constrained by the factors that were promulgated by the Attorney General. And I'm not sure whether the second argument is in fact, it can't be constrained by any factors. I think they said, no, it can be, but not these factors. So is that inconsistent with Bastardo?
Well, so, Your Honor, I think their argument takes a step further back and really says, I think the premise of their argument is that they view this as a per se or categorical rule, which they think because of the first sentence, the second sentence, that would make the rule inconsistent with the second sentence. Our position is that it is not a per se or categorical rule. As I think petitioners and amicus acknowledge, there are, at least in their view, two decisions of this court, or one decision of this court and one board decision that we've presented in our appendix, where the presumption was rebutted. So then the question becomes, well, what does the statute allow the Attorney General to do? And we think here, this statute expressly delegates the authority to the Attorney General to make these types of rules, which this court recognized 1231 does allow, give that express authority to the Attorney General. There, we think there's nothing inconsistent about the Attorney General making even a very strong presumption.
If it undermines the tenor, the spirit of the second sentence, which is to be individualized. I mean, does constrain in a particular type of offense what kind of relief an individual can get. And this is an asylum where it was promulgated by regulation. This is a pronouncement by the Attorney General. I don't disagree with my colleagues that the Attorney General has certain roles in the process, but is it permitted to undermine the individualized assessment that's contemplated by the second sentence?
Your Honor, fundamentally, we believe that this matter of while does allow for the type of individualized determination. I would point the court back to its decision in Chong. There it was looking at matter of LS, which is a different framework, but fundamentally when discussing what the case-by-case determination requires, Chong said it's be entitled to fact-finding on a record before the board and disclose to the petitioner, be allowed to make arguments on their own behalf and have a right to that determination. And here, that's exactly what's happened before the IJ and the board. All of the factual findings were made in the record. The petitioner had the ability to present evidence, had an appeal to the board. And I think that's really the heart of what kind of whether you view it as due process or statutory authorization. I think Chong wasn't entirely clear on that point. But in either respect, I think the petitioner has been afforded that opportunity to raise these claims. Simply that because of her plea and then conviction under the statute of 1 kilogram more heroin, that falls foul of the first element of matter YL. But I don't see that as an issue of the Attorney General's statutory authority to create this strong presumption.
So, Mr. Nardi, educate me on this point. This rule was adopted in 2002 in the matter of YL.
Correct.
And it becomes precedential. Subsequent attorney generals have come along. Can they override what was decided in matter of YL themselves, or does it have to go before the full BIA? What's the process?
Your Honor, my understanding of the process is there is a certification of a case that would overturn that. That case is then certified to the Attorney General, and the Attorney General in a precedential decision can overrule prior Attorney General decisions.
And that hasn't been done? That has not been done since 2002.
It has happened in other cases. It has not been without
it. Hasn't happened in this case.
No. Yes.
But this goes to the point we were asking earlier, that there's a fairly long-standing recognition of the rule that goes beyond one moment in time. It's been not challenged by Congress. It doesn't appear to have been challenged by other attorneys general. So that would show consistency, I assume?
Your Honor, I think that shows that courts have continually upheld its decisions and the application of YL. I think—
Well, not the court, the executive branch, right? That's Judge Fisher's point, is that multiple attorneys general have had the opportunity to reconsider matter of YL, and they have not.
Correct. And also, just to respond to my friend's point about other more recent attorney general decisions, we think even under the YL presumption framework, these other decisions can be taken into account and other factors can be taken into account. It's simply that the first six factors have to be met. And then, as the attorney general said in YL, then other considerations can be taken.
How is that individualized? I still don't have an answer to that question. How is that individualized?
Your Honor, because the facts of the case, the IJ and board are still looking at the individual facts of the case. They're simply applying a different set of standards that are being applied to the individual case. However, as this court noted in Lopez and other board decisions that we've submitted in our appendix show, in those cases, IJ and the board have, looking at the individualized set of circumstances, found that no, the presumptions have been rebutted.
I know this is a rebuttal presumption. I'm recognizing the cases that you brought to our attention says it can be rebutted. But this makes a explain to me how this is not a categorical rule for drug offenses. It's not about the alien's conduct specifically. It's like, if you have a drug offense, then you are to presume the following absent rebuttal. How is not that categorical as compared to individual?
Well, Your Honor, I would say, I think that question goes more to the what is the power of the Attorney General to make different types of presumptions with under 1231, that
and
sentence.
My point is, how can he make a categorical framework that I've described if the second sentence on which he was relying on for his authority has been interpreted to say it must be individualized?
Because we think that individualized determination goes with respect to the individual alien, not with respect to the type of crimes or the types, categories of things that the Attorney General could make different standards
okay,
for.
Okay, part of the problem that exists in this case is that the petitioner has a slightly different argument. And the first criteria limits the kind of case because it refers only to a small quantity of a controlled substance. And we know kilos aren't considered by anybody to be small quantity. But she has, in effect, the coercion and duress arguments that these categories preclude her from raising. And doesn't that eliminate the case-by-case analysis as it relates to her?
So our position is that no, Your Honor, because those categories are factors still could be analyzed, because under matter of YL, you must first meet the six enumerated elements. However, then there is still a more totality of the circumstances analysis applied after. And those
you can't get out off the first block, as Judge Fisher was alluding to, you never get to consider those others.
Sir, it comes down to a question of whether or not the Attorney General has the ability to make an admittedly strong presumption. I think the Attorney General in YL
sounds to me like it's an absolute presumption. I mean, well, he could have very easily said anybody who is convicted of a drug offense over a half a kilo is not going to be eligible for withholding. He could have just said that.
I notice my time is up, but
your answer would be yes, he could just say that.
Your Honor, I think making those types of categorical rules is a much different question than the question before the court. And fundamentally, I think that our response to you would be that there have been examples of the presumption being rebutted. And so that is fundamentally the difference. Because if the Attorney General had simply said, yes, drug trafficking convictions are categorically particularly serious crimes when they're even when they're under 5 years, that's a very different case. The Attorney General expressly stated he was not making a decision in matter of while, and we don't think that should apply here.
Okay. I see your point.
Judge Fisher?
No, that's
okay. Thank you for your argument.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm just four brief points. First, it's this court's role to ensure that the Attorney General doesn't exercise more discretion than what Congress delegated to him or her under the statute. And that's even more clear now after Loper-Bright. And this court has already done that. This court has used the traditional tools of statutory construction in Stardovale to interpret the statute and held that that it does require an individualized case-by-case determination. That was the prior agency practice, and that's what Congress intended to continue to permit in the second part of that statute. And Congress, in 1996, it made an exception to that background rule that this court has already recognized. It made one exception for aggravated felonies with a five-year sentence.
I'm just going to pause this for a second. Could you turn the clock on for us?
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
No worries.
So,
interrupt you, counsel.
No, that's okay. Congress chose to make one exception to that background rule from Bastardo Valle. Third, Your Honor, the prior cases that my friend raised, of course, were unpublished, and in neither Ford nor Marsan did the petitioner really raise the issue of whether the matter of YL conflicted with the statute. The issue hasn't been decided by this court, and certainly not since Loper Bright.
What's our basis for jurisdiction? Do you have a position?
Yes, Your Honor. Page 2200 of Riley plainly contemplated that people who are seeking review of their CAT claims will be able to get judicial review. There's a lengthy discussion of the practical issues created by the timing rule. And the 11th Circuit in Velasquez actually has recently decided a petition for review where timeliness was waived, and it went ahead and decided on the merits. Just two more quick points, Your Honor. My friend mentioned under Chong, it's important that someone can raise arguments on their own behalf. Ms. Laureano couldn't. She tried, her attorney tried to make arguments, but they were foreclosed by YL because only the statute of conviction. She couldn't explain what happened, why it happened, why the facts of the case didn't show that she's a danger to the community. And that's what Congress intended her to be able to do and was precluded here.
I'm going to ask you just to pause for one second.
Sure. Well, thanks, but I think you ought to force the government to...
I'm sorry, counsel, you can have back your time and finish that. And I was able to...
Understood, Your Honor. No, just finally, that even if the court believes that the attorney general has the power to make rules, they have to be rational and consistent with other cases. And again, the attorney general has just recently emphasized that danger is the essential key in matter of BZR, and what YL precluded my client from presenting any facts that would allow the IJ to make a conclusion about danger in her case.
And you're about whether she was danger. Is that the point you're talking about?
Yes, that whether her conviction indicates that she is a danger.
Understood. Yep. Okay. Thank you for your argument.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Give me one second. Counsel, just remain seated. Okay. Thank you for that momentary pause. And thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We understand everyone here is just representing a client. We get that. But you can understand when the court calls a case, particularly this circuit calls a case for oral argument, a good deal of preparation goes in, seriousness goes in, so that we can engage in fruitful conversations. And we did have some fruitful conversations today. The court will, thanks counsel again, and we'll take this matter under advisement.